Okay, so we're going to start a new chapter today on psychological disorders. Incidentally, I was at a conference in Chicago last week, and I was able to talk a little bit about the project that you're involved with, the psychophysiology experiments and that kind of thing. And people are very excited about it, very impressed by what we're doing. So it's just wanted to let you know you're part of something big that is hopefully going to make some changes in how we teach this course. So psychological disorders. What is a psychological disorder? And notice that I put the word disorder in scare quotes, because it implies that there's some distinction between disorder and what would be its opposite, which is order. So what's a psychological disorder? What's that?
Depression
is one example, but sort of how would you define the concept of a psychological disorder? Yeah, Stacy first. Okay, so some sort of discomfort or dis-ease, yeah.
Maybe some sort of deviation.
Deviation, good.
Kind of
so deviation from normal, yeah. What else? Yeah, Lauren. So a psychological disorder may be some sort of disordered chemical process in your body. Could be part of a psychological disorder. So things are not quite right. They're out of order. They're not sorted, right? And so another word for psychological disorders that we use is psychopathology. And in fact, the psychology department just went through a discussion of whether we want to change the name of our abnormal psychology course to indicate that it's more about psychopathology. And the roots for this word are in psyche, which has to do with the mind or the soul, remember, in Greek. Path, pathos, pathology, patho, which has to do with some sort of suffering or maybe disease, and then the science of ology. So where we have psychology, which is the science of the mind or the soul, when we talk about psychopathology, that's a little bit different. That's about the science of studying how our mind or soul suffers or is diseased, right? And so when we talk about psychopathology, one of the terms that we'll use is mental health, right? So we talk about the mental health care system or taking care of your mental health. Right? And so this implies that there's something about lack of health, mental illness, which might be related to these diseases. So what this is reflecting is the notion of what we're going to call the medical model, and I'll talk to you about this a little bit later. The idea that we think of psychological disorders in the conception of how we think of other medical disorders, other medical problems. Not necessarily that they're always caused by something in your body, but rather that we can actually look at symptoms, we can classify those symptoms in an orderly way so that we can find out what treatments work well for what symptoms, and eventually hopefully find some cures for those problems, right? So if you want to know more about these disorders specifically, you can take an abnormal psychology course. Here it's Psy 239, and it'll go into these disorders in excruciating detail.
Which is a great class.
Oh, okay. So despite the excruciating detail, you really enjoy it?
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, don't take two psych classes at the same time. And one of the things that we kind of run through in abnormal psych is the idea of whether behaviors are functional or perhaps dysfunctional. What does it mean for a behavior to be functional? Okay. I think it's more than just not disruptive. So positive on what you're doing, a little more specifically. Think about, for example, the functionalist perspective in psychology. What was that about? So remember, the functionalist perspective grew out of the Darwin's theory of natural selection and the idea that our behaviors are adaptations. They are adaptations that allow us to function effectively in our environment, to survive and thrive. So functional behaviors are those that, you know, allow us to thrive in this environment. Dysfunctional behaviors, on the other hand, are going to be behaviors that maybe cause us some problems with functioning effectively, with adapting to our environment, adapting to the people around us, to our social environment, right? So one of these behaviors, more on the, quote, functional end generally, is what we'll call normal behavior. But it's not necessarily functional. What does it mean for behavior to be normal? What's that?
Stable
perhaps, yeah. Although there might be situations in which instable behavior might be normal, unstable behavior might. What's that?
Common,
good. Okay, so everybody else thinks you should behave that way. So that's getting into the idea of social norms, right? Normal norms are social norms. And so mostly normal behavior is defined by all of us. You know, we kind of come to some implicit agreement of what normal behavior is. And when someone is behaving outside of that norm, then we say, well, they're abnormal or weird, right? People in high school or junior high have these very restrictive notions of what is normal. And anything outside of that is weird, right? What about this word, eccentric? What does it mean to be eccentric?
Like a
polite way of saying you're crazy. Okay. What else?
Different,
unusual. Not quite normal, energetic maybe, what's that?
I always think of people, like when somebody says somebody's eccentric, as somebody who's a little off and weird, but they don't care.
A little bit weird. They don't particularly care. Now, how does their little bit of weirdness affect other people?
It can make them
a little bit uncomfortable, but generally it doesn't really, they don't get upset about it, right? Yeah, yeah. So when we think about, what we're ultimately dealing with here is the spectrum of behavior from normal to pathological. And so in the spectrum of normal to pathological, eccentric is not necessarily a problem for the individual or for other people. Generally, their eccentricities are not dangerous to themselves or other people, right? So we generally, you know, go along with these people, and they say, well, what's this this thing in Portland? Keep Portland weird, right? So Portland has this sort of self-consciousness, as if a city can have self-consciousness. But, you know, there's this undercurrent of people who think that Portland should be weird, right? Eccentric, right? Now, what about this word? Neurotic. She's neurotic. Out of control. What else? What's that?
Obsessive.
Anxious, right? You think, when I think of neurotic, I think of Woody Allen. He's the classic neurotic character. What's that?
Is it all the bad words that were described as for a rule of
test? Yeah. Yeah. So neurotic, right? So this is a more disturbing to other people typically. The individual is oftentimes disturbed, maybe by their own behavior. Generally, they're not going to be very dangerous to themselves or other people. But they're probably going to, you know, like Woody Allen, he's going to have problems in interpersonal relationships, right? That's the classic theme of his movies, is problems that he has in trying to have interpersonal relationships. So what we start seeing now is that the less functional people are, the more they move sort of down the levels into the levels of psychopathology or abnormality. Psychotic. What does that mean? What's that? Dangerous, perhaps. Yeah. So some sort of chemical, unpredictable. Good. Unpredictable. Maybe dangerous. What else? Crazy, irrational, usually. What's that? Unstable. Yeah, very much. So we start talking about like cognitive problems. They're not thinking straight. They're not. Their feelings are all over the map. You know, they're very maybe dangerous because of their agitated behaviors combined with these unstable emotions and irrational thinking. Right. So they could be dangerous to themselves. It could be dangerous to other people. So this is mostly what we're going to talk about in terms of psychological disorders, although it borders up into neurotic. But mostly we're worried about people who are having more severe functional problems than just individuals who maybe are having a few problems in interpersonal relationships, for example. So the more serious kinds of psychological disorders are down here in the psychotic or psychopathic realm. Okay, any questions on this? Ideas? This is, you know, by the way, this is just my levels of, this isn't necessarily written in stone somewhere. I just want to give you a sense of the continuum of abnormality. So it's not like people are crazy or not crazy. We're all crazy. It's just a matter of how crazy we are, how dysfunctional our craziness is, right? On the other hand, don't forget that if someone is trying so hard to maintain social norms and to appear normal, that it's causing disruptions in their work or causing disruptions in their interpersonal relationships, that's going to be a problem too. So there's kind of two sides to the coin, right? Some people can be really intensely obsessive about being normal or being seen as good, right? And so then we start getting into things like, for example, eating disorders are partly a response of trying to look like they think they should look. But of course, people with eating disorders oftentimes have disruptions in their own image of themselves and their body. So that's a whole nother ball of wax. Okay, so let's talk about what Lefton and Brannon will tell you abnormal behavior is. First of all, they say it's not. They say it's uncommon, so it's essentially rare statistically. They'll also talk about the notion of social norms and the idea that abnormal behavior is generally considered socially unacceptable. Although, again, someone who is neurotic, for example, might be able to be considered socially acceptable, but their neurotic behavior might cause them problems. So that's where we get into the idea that abnormal behavior causes some sort of distress. Now, that just doesn't mean distress to the individual, but distress maybe to other people who the individual, who are depending on the individual, or other people who are in love with the individual or love them. Also, that it is maladaptive, which is another way of saying dysfunctional. So someone with abnormal behavior isn't going to be able to adapt effectively to changes in their environment, you know, their social environment, their work situation, their personal relationships. So can they adapt effectively? And then last, I don't think this is particularly important, but they do add the caveat at the end that that it might involve distorted cognition, but that's really a symptom of some kind of some of the disorders. And so this doesn't really have too much to do with really what we would, how I think we should classify abnormal behavior. So typicality, distress, maladaptivity, and social acceptability. Now, Lefton and Brannon have their particular way of saying it. Most of the other, most of the classifications for abnormality, though, deal with some common features, and some of them overlap with Lefton and Brannon. But there are generally three or four things that they think about, and I'll call this the 4D model. The behavior is distressful to the self or others. It is deviant, right? So it deviates from social norms. It is dysfunctional. We talked about that. That's important. And lastly, if the behavior is dangerous to the self or others, then it's definitely a problem and abnormal. So these four characteristics, I think, really carry the notion of abnormality. The textbook that we're using right now in abnormal psych, they use the term harmful dysfunction to describe abnormality. Basically, you know, it's dysfunctional behavior that is causing some harm to the individual or other people, which really covers a lot of this stuff too. So there's different ways of defining it, but I think these are four really important characteristics that we can distill down into one word each. Questions, ideas on the notions of abnormality? So look at this. Distressful, deviant, dysfunctional. All three of these, this is not going to be so important in terms of culture, but all three of these are really culturally defined, aren't they? And so now we start getting into the issue of cultural relativism. In one culture, in North American culture, it is abnormal, it's definitely deviant, it may be dysfunctional and even distressful to scar your skin as a decoration, right? Up until maybe 15 years ago, tattooing was considered deviant, right? And maybe in the last 5 to 10 years, it's become more normal, right? So not only do we have to look at differences between cultures, we have to look at changes within cultures when we start talking about abnormality. So here's a classic. What's called female circumcision, or sometimes female mutilation, which is the removal of the clitoris from a girl, typically an adolescent girl, before she's married. And so genital mutilation, as it's called, and it's not uncommon in some African cultures, for example, created a huge problem in the, I think it was in 1999, there was the Congress on Women's Rights, the UN Congress on Women's Rights, which is held in China. And so one of the One of the disagreements here was the notion of female mutilation, female circumcision, and the idea of that a lot of countries wanted to put that into the Declaration of Women's Rights, that they wouldn't have to be subjected to that, right? But then there were women from countries where that was normal, and they had a problem with that, right? Because who are you to come from outside and tell me what's normal in my culture, right? So there's all kinds of problems with kind of saying what's normal, what's abnormal. And it really has to be defined by the culture in general. That's a bit of a problem. That is a bit of a problem, because that's subject greatly to the whims of culture, the whims of politics, right? So this is not an easy topic. And that's why, you know, we can spend a whole term talking about abnormality and the problems with abnormality. Questions, comments on this? Idea of normality, abnormality? The female circumcision, genital mutilation? Yeah, it is. It's fairly disturbing. You know, and some people, you know, of course, they also point to the notion of in North American culture that that circumcision, male circumcision, is normal. And how is that not, you know, mutilation, right, of a baby that doesn't have a choice in it, right? So, yeah. So there's... Sure, it could be terrifying, although it could be in some ways comforting, because you're joining the culture. You know, you are being welcomed into this group of women who have had this done, right? So now you're part of them, right? So there's all kinds of ways to look at it. Yeah, it could be disturbing, but it also could be comforting, right? So these are problems with talking about abnormality and how we're going to define abnormality. Yes? Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, there are some reasonable arguments in terms of medical problems, because oftentimes the labia are also sewn shut with just a small hole for urine and menses to menstrual fluid to be released, and that can cause a lot of problems biologically for women. But that's another story altogether. Mm-hmm. Okay, so how have historically and prehistorically people dealt with the notion of abnormality, mental illness, mental health? Up until ancient periods, up until we start seeing some sort of written history, mostly what we're dealing with is the idea that there are some kind of supernatural cause for abnormal behavior. And one of the interesting things we find in archaeological digs are sometimes individuals with holes drilled neatly into their head, into their skulls. You know, skulls that are that have these very neat holes drilled in them. So they're obviously not some sort of random injury that they're suffering, but rather an some sort of intentional means of opening up the skull. And one of the hypotheses about this is the idea that it may be a way to release spirits that maybe are trapped in the skull, or demons, or something that needs to get out, right? On the other hand, this is also a way to relieve pressure from an injury. So if your meninges, the layer of cells on the surface of your brain, if the meninges are injured, they will sometimes swell up, and that swelling can cause brain damage. So they may also be a way, they may also have been attempts to relieve some of that pressure. So it's really unclear whether trephination was intended to treat psychological disorders. But starting with ancient recorded history, we start seeing in Egypt, for example, trying to understand what are called somatogenic causes. Somatogenic. Soma, the body, genic, the origin of these diseases in the body, right? And so, and then when we look at Greece in about 500 BC, with the rise of medicine and Hippocrates, what we start seeing is more focus on the body. And in particular, psychological disturbances were explained as a function of a couple of things. One of those was what were called bodily humors. So these were fluids that moved around in the body. It was sort of the hydraulic model. And the idea was that if you had too much of one kind of fluid or another, then that would cause disrupted behavior. And so the four fluids, the four humors were black bile, yellow bile, urine, and blood. Is that right? Yeah. So when these things came out, when these things became unbalanced, these humors became unbalanced, that's when disordered, disruptive behavior emerged. Now, what's interesting is that's not too far off of our current physiological conception of the origin of these disorders, rooted in things like neurotransmitters and hormones, right? So really, you know, they might have been onto something, just not quite there. Another cause of disordered behavior, especially in women, was referred to as hysteria. And it was the notion that the uterus in a woman would become dislodged and would begin moving around her abdomen and cause all kinds of disruptions in bodily function and in behavior. So you don't want your uterus wandering around your abdomen. So keep it where it's supposed to be. That's obviously not thought of as a current conception of psychological disorder, but we do still have the term, don't we? Hysterical, right? So that's a kind of a sexist term. It's a bad word. Anyway, during the medieval period, we see a move back to, to a large degree, back to supernatural explanations. The Greek rationalism gives way to the church and the church's explanations for these disorders. And this is a period when we see, for example, people with disordered behavior being burned as witches, right? People with disordered behavior put into asylums. And these are basically dungeons, cages. Big buildings that you lock somebody in there for the rest of their life, And in fact, they would then be used to entertain the local populace. The people who ran the asylums would charge admission for people to come in and watch the crazy people, right? So this is a, you know, this is hugely disturbing. This is a really disturbing period in the treatment of psychological disorders, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Very much so.
Sure.
Many people who don't even give bipolar, those things, a second thought. It's just, it's a spiritual thing, and they pray, and they pray, and they pray, and they see a lot of deliverance and just different things like that.
So yeah.
I think that you know, there was something there back then.
Yeah. So there is, you know, there are still individuals and sects who believe that the appropriate treatment for psychological disorders is a spiritual one. And just recently here in Oregon, we had a couple whose child died as a result of them trying to pursue a spiritual cure, which ultimately apparently didn't work.
Psychological?
Well, it was physical, but we, you know, where do you draw the line between physiological disorders and psychological disorders? Because so much of psychological disorders are rooted in physiology also. So, yeah. Yeah.
I was curious, you said that people pay money to go to the asylums. Do you think that's where, for lack of a better word, like free shows or services?
Yeah, right. Sure. Probably. Yeah. Yeah. We. I mean, there's something voyeuristic in us that really, we really enjoy seeing things that are weird and abnormal and, all right. I don't know what it is, but and watching, you know, to as long as we aren't part of it, we sometimes might enjoy, or we know that it's fictional, we might enjoy watching other people suffer. Yeah. 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 Right. Oh, well, like the catharsis, and so it's a way to, or it's a way to, what's the word? Can't remember. Okay, so anyway, these asylums, it turns out, don't come out of thin air. They actually were already built, and they were built because in from about 700 AD until about 900 AD, there was a disease that ran through Europe called leprosy. And leprosy is an extraordinarily, it's a contagious disorder, and it causes in a large degree deterioration of body cells. And so it's an awful disorder. And partly it was one of the products of the Crusades. When the Crusaders came back from the Middle East, they brought back leprosy with them. And so leprosy was ravaging Europe, and what they would do is they built these leprosariums, they were called, these big warehouses to house these lepers. And after they contained leprosy and the disease was no longer a problem, these big empty buildings were sitting around, and people go, hey, let's put the crazy people in the big buildings. Because they're causing problems for the family, right? They're going to cause a problem for the family, they're going to cause a problem for the community if their behavior is so disordered and disruptive and dangerous, right? So they wind up getting put in the asylums. And pretty much that's the treatment for the next 600, 700, 800 years. 900 years, really, until the 20th century. And we'll start to see that we can empty out these warehouses of people. Questions? So far. It's about 10 of. Why don't we take a break until 12 noon? No, I don't have them recorded yet. I have them marked, but just not recorded. But I'll get them back to you. Okay, we're back. The asylum model pretty much carries through up until the 18th and 19th centuries, so the 1700s and 1800s. And what we'll see is during this period, we see more of the development of what we'll call the medical model of abnormality and psychological disorders. And the medical model really talks about the idea that there are symptoms, there are treatments, and from those symptoms and treatments, we can maybe develop cures, start understanding the disorders better. So this is gonna begin to sort of start taking some of the stigma out of mental illness. And stigma is one of the big problems in mental illness. The problem of other people and how they interpret psychological disorders. When you're stigmatized, you know, you're held up as an example of what is bad, right? And so stigmatization is a huge problem. And what this is also going to do is it's going to begin removing some of the stigma from the families, because oftentimes these disorders were seen as something defective in relationship to the family, not just the individual. And when we start seeing it in the medical model view, we start seeing it just as symptoms of a disorder, symptoms of a disease. And so it can be less a moral failing of the family and more of a more something similar to any other physiological illness. Also, in the 18th and 19th centuries, we start to see the emergence of what will be called the moral therapy movement. The idea that we have to do more for these people than just put them in a warehouse, feed them, you know, give them water, and let them die there. We have an obligation to try to heal these people, to try to make their lives comfortable, try to bring them back from their disorder as much as we can. So the moral therapy movement is going to be led by really three people. I hope your book talks about this. Dorothea Dix in the United States, Philippe Pinel in France, and then William Tuke in England. There's a couple of others that were involved. But they really drove the idea that we have to start treating these people. We can't just put them away and lock them up. So what'll happen is we'll begin trying to develop some therapies to help people. Some of them are going to be useful. A lot of them are not. We're going to be trying to help people with very limited knowledge of what causes the disorders, very limited knowledge of all of the symptoms of the disorders and how to alleviate those symptoms. So I'll show you, when we talk about treatment, I'll show you some of those early attempts that were ultimately not that useful. For example, one way to treat melancholy and anxiety was to take people and put them in a spa, you know, take them and, you know, put them up, you know, where they can be fed in a natural environment that's very relaxing, right? You know, they can take hot baths, they can just, you know, sort of decompress from the world. And that was useful for a while, but ultimately didn't turn out to be a long-lasting treatment. But we'll talk more about that when we talk about treatments. Now, the big thing for the 20th century is the idea of deinstitutionalization, taking these people out of these big institutional asylums and moving them back out into the community. And one of the really the only way that the deinstitutionalization movement can work will be because of the discovery of psychopharmacology and psychopharmacological agents. Early early on in the 20th century, Sigmund Freud develops the notion of psychoanalysis and what will become psychotherapy. So Freud, remember, was working in France at the end of the 1900s, at the end of the 18th century, and he was working with wealthy Parisian women, and he was hypnotizing them, and they were experiencing some remission from their conversion disorders, right? So these are disorders of the body that women would experience, where they would lose, for example, their arm would become paralyzed, or they'd lose all feeling in their hand, something called glove anesthesia. And these conversion disorders, Freud chalked up to the sexual conflicts that they experienced in childhood and how that carried over into adulthood. And so he would use hypnosis, and they would experience a remission of their symptoms, but eventually they would come back. And Freud said, I want to do something more permanent than that. And that's when he starts developing the notion of what will become free association therapy. And in free association, basically you just let the patient talk about their feelings, their thoughts, and you look for a point where they become blocked, where they can't talk about it anymore. And Freud would say that that's the point of repression, where they're trying to repress something. And what we need to do is we need to find out what they're repressing. So then he would work more intensely in that particular area. And ultimately, that would become what we do now, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. So he's really important in terms of his theories, which are pretty wacky, but more importantly for his development of what will become psychotherapy. The other important thing in terms of deinstitutionalization, and perhaps more important for deinstitutionalization, is the development of psychopharmacology. Psycho, the mind, pharmacology, right? Pharmacy, medicine, drugs. So this is the development of psychoactive medications that are going to be useful in treating psychological disorders. Particularly, what will be developed are the antipsychotic medications that are going to be useful for treating schizophrenia, which has very disturbed behaviors that make it very difficult to function in everyday life. And so with the development of the antipsychotic drugs, now we can actually treat these people and they can go back to their normal lives. Their behavior becomes so much more normal that they can actually start functioning again. So now the warehouses start to empty out. And what's going to happen is we're going to move to what's known as a community-based care system, where instead of having these big state hospitals, we have smaller clinics out in the community that are monitoring these people and helping them maintain their medication regimens and that kind of thing, and their therapies and whatever. The problem was that as the hospitals get closed and these community care facilities start operating, they're not really sufficiently funded by the federal government, and the state governments aren't picking it up. And so what will happen is we'll start to see a rise in homelessness, and particularly individuals who are homeless that have a mental illness. And because these mental illnesses can be so disruptive to the person's thinking, can be so disruptive to the person's behavior, and so disturbing to other people, it's going to make it hard for them to hold down jobs, have apartments, live a normal life. And so so that's going to start to become a big problem really in the late 1970s into the 1980s and 1990s. And it still is a problem. Okay, any questions on 20th century stuff? Moral therapy? Well, if we're going to really effectively treat psychological disorders and understand them effectively, we're going to need to try to understand what causes them. And so when we start talking about causes of disorders, you know, we have some ideas already. You know, we've got this supernatural perspective, which basically says that there's some unknowable force, some force outside of the individual, force that we can't comprehend that may be influencing and causing the individual's disturbed behavior. That's not particularly useful, although it does help to explain why the disorder may occur. But the two approaches that are currently more useful in terms of understanding therapy and treatment are the somatogenic causes, basically that there's some problem in the body, some functional problem in the body that's causing this disturbed behavior. And ultimately, what we're seeing now in terms of somatogenic explanations for mental illness in the research that we're doing is, for one thing, we see oftentimes dysfunctions in brain functioning and processing. So certain parts of the brain may be less functional or overly functional in certain disorders. Yeah, Emily, do you have a question? It is huge. So the question is, So the question is, can drug addiction induce psychological disorders? There are some classes of drugs that can, particularly the amphetamines, can induce what's called amphetamine psychosis. And amphetamine psychosis essentially looks just like paranoid schizophrenia. So delusions, hallucination. What's that? Well, partly, but also just because their body systems are all whacked out, yeah. So in amphetamine psychosis, you get delusions, you get distorted thinking, you get visual and auditory hallucinations. And it basically, yeah, it's the person is out of control.
Can it go on to have a long-lasting effect?
Typically, amphetamine psychosis will resolve after you stop doing the drugs. There is a residual effect, but it becomes less with time. There are some other, some of the hallucinogens, if they're used chronically, and in high doses can result in some permanent changes in perception, but that's relatively rare. The depressant drugs, I don't know if there's any connection between the depressants and and later psychological disorders. But what we'll see is that substance use disorders or addictions are oftentimes what we call comorbid, or they occur at the same time, or they may be a coping mechanism for someone who has another psychological disorder. Okay, so for example, someone with alcoholism may be partly using the alcohol as a self-medication for some other disorder like depression or anxiety. Yeah. Yep.
And she would mix, you know, her medication for the bipolar issue and some anxiety issues with amphetamines.
Okay.
And the result was, and so I'd always hear the doctors and stuff talk about drug-induced psychosis. And,
right.
I mean, the result was just, I mean, there was a guy that was always in the house by the laundry room in a trench coat who was never really there.
Right, right. Yeah, that's not good.
No.
because visual hallucinations and delusions are not. For the most part, visual hallucinations aren't associated with bipolar,
exactly.
But they can be. They can't. Yeah. So yeah, it's not a good idea to go off label on these drugs. The interactions are pretty can be pretty harsh. One of the other big areas of research is in the effect of neurotransmitters, how neurotransmitters affect our behavior, and particularly how they affect psychological disordered behavior. So we're looking at the neurotransmitters, for example, in depression. One of the big neurotransmitter systems is serotonin. And we have, for the last 30, 40 years, been looking very strongly at serotonin in relationship to depression. We're starting to get more and more evidence that that may not have been actually very correct, but we do know that there are some neurotransmitter dysfunctions in psychological disorders. Hormonal dysfunctions, so changes in hormones are going to cause changes in behavior, as we're all well aware. And genetics. So big area now with understanding more about genetics in the human genome, being able to map that out, is being able to understand the genetic basis, if any, of psychological disorders. So the two big ones, the two major genetically influenced disorders that we know of are schizophrenia, which has a high genetic component, and bipolar disorder, or what used to be called manic depressive disorder, or manic depressive illness. And both of them, if you have a first order relative, so a parent, sibling, or child who has bipolar or schizophrenia, then you're at a higher risk for developing the disorder. But that doesn't mean that you will, because there are other factors which we'll talk about. And then the third cause that we think of in terms of psychological disorders is the psychogenic cause, the idea that these disorders and the symptoms especially of these disorders are caused by disruptions in cognition and disruptions in emotion. Okay. But ultimately, the psychogenic explanation says that our disturbed behavior is a product of our experiences. So remember that this is mostly coming out of the psychogenic perspective is coming out of the psychodynamic perspective, which says that it's childhood conflicts, right, that are the unconscious childhood conflicts that are a source of our disturbed behavior. But then also with the behaviorist perspective gaining prominence in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, we start seeing some interest in the idea that these disturbed behaviors, these abnormal behaviors, may actually be learned. So we know now, for example, that phobias are oftentimes classically conditioned early in life. And Freud proposed, in terms of learned behaviors and psychogenic causes of schizophrenia, he proposed the idea of what were called schizophrenogenic mothers, and that a particular mothering style produced children with schizophrenia. And that's largely discredited at this point, but we do know that there are some relationships between schizophrenia and family systems. And oftentimes when we treat a psychological disorder, it doesn't just involve treating the individual with the disorder, but also treating the family, because the family has to support that person in their recovery from the disorder and getting well. And that's oftentimes a hard thing to do when families have become so entrenched in their behavioral systems that were built around this person with the disorder. It's hard to change those behavioral systems, right? Questions on these proposed causes? Okay. So let's talk about the medical model and how we currently understand psychological disorders. In order for you to be treated when you go to the doctor has to know what's, you know, what's going on with you. So you go into the doctor, you say, well, I've got these symptoms, you know, got a runny nose, sore throat, a little bit of a cough, and the doctor says, huh, well, you probably have a virus, right? You probably have a, you know, a virus, an upper respiratory infection. It's probably viral, and there's nothing we can do about it because we don't have any effective treatments for viruses, so go home, drink lots of fluids, take Tylenol, and be miserable for a few days, right? So you go home, you drink a bunch of fluids, you take Tylenol, you're miserable, and a week later it's still not getting better, and you go back to the doctor and he says, huh, well, usually these viruses resolve in a week, right? So here's what we'll do. We will test and see if you have a bacterial infection, right? So they, you know, I don't know, they swab, do whatever, culture the bacteria. And he says, oh, okay, yeah, you've got a bacterial infection here. Take these antibiotics and you'll be better in 2 weeks. And you go home, you take all the antibiotics and you're all better. And presumably the antibiotics actually resolved the infection. That may or may not be true, but be that as it may, the medical model revolves around the idea of the diagnosis and then differential diagnosis, right? So when somebody comes to you with a cold, you know, with cold symptoms, you know, runny nose, sore throat, you know, not much of a fever maybe, and you say, well, it could be a virus, could be bacterial, how are we going to know? That diagnosis comes out of what? Experience, a whole history of seeing these particular sets of symptoms and treating those particular sets of symptoms and finding out which treatments work and which treatments don't. And so really that's the medical model. We're looking at classifying sets of symptoms so that we can come up with a diagnosis. Also, knowing what treatments work for those sets of symptoms, right? And ultimately, if we know what these symptoms are like, we know what treats them, we can start working on finding cures. So we have some cures for medical problems by, you know, physiological illnesses. But unfortunately, in psychological disorders, we really don't have many cures at all. There are only just a few. And so we're still in this part of the medical model with psychological disorders. But it's an important part because it allows us to start classifying these disorders. And when we classify them, we can find out what works for this class of disorders and what doesn't work for this class of disorders. But it's a new, it's still a new science. So let's talk a little bit in detail about diagnosis. So a diagnosis essentially describes a specific set of behaviors or a specific set of symptoms, right? I go to the doctor, I say, I'm sniffling, got a cough, and what does he ask me next? So what kinds of things are going on? How long has this been going on, right? Changes that you've gone through. So these are ways to try to pin down what might be leading up to this condition. So one of the things we look at in psychological disorders, just like we do in medical disorders, is how long has this been going on and how frequently does it occur? Does it, you know, has it been going on for a week? And does it happen to you you know, a week out of every month, right? And so ultimately, what we're going to do is we're going to start collecting these sets of symptoms or behaviors and the durations and frequencies, and we're going to publish them in what's called the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association. And the DSM is sort of the Bible for diagnosis of psychological disorders. Now, the DSM doesn't generally tell you how to treat these disorders. It's generally telling you how to figure out the difference between, say, depression and bipolar disorder, which share some common features. So being able to differentially diagnose disorders that are similar. How to differentiate between major depression and what's called dysthymia, right? Okay. Currently, the current version of the DSM is called the DSM-4, TR, there's a text revision, which was published in 2004. The DSM-5 will be coming out probably in 2011. And so every so often, and there's no regular frequency, but every so often, there's an update to this DSM. The DSM-4 was a major update. The DSM-3 was probably the most major update, which happened in the 1980s. And what happened in the DSM-3 is they started moving away from the psychodynamic model for explaining disorders, these unconscious conflicts, and more toward a biological and psychogenic learned behavior model. And so so one of the disorders that was removed in the DSM-3, for example, was homosexuality. Homosexuality was considered a psychological disorder to be treated up until the early 1980s in the publication of the DSM-3. What's that? Well, they would treat it using they would treat it using psychoanalysis. They'd try to find where the sexual conflict was in their childhood that was, you know, causing these behaviors. Yeah, you know, and the mostly that particular change in the DSM was driven by psychiatrists who were homosexual themselves and were thinking, gee, this is not good. This is, how are we actually classifying disorders? And that's when we started moving to this notion of dysfunction, distress, dangerousness. And these weren't considered highly dysfunctional behaviors. They weren't considered dangerous. They weren't considered distressful. And so that started moving out of abnormality into normality. So our conceptions of what is normal and abnormal behavior is going to change, and our conceptions of what is psychologically treatable is going to change over time, too. So the DSM-3 became much more science-based and much less psychodynamic-based and more based in research. The DSM-4 continued that. The DSM-5 is going to be almost a revolutionary change in terms of reliance more on genetic information that we have now, biological predispositions for disorders, biological correlates of disorders. So it's moving away, you know, we've had this move over the last 100 years away from psychodynamic and more toward biological explanations for behaviors. That doesn't mean that this is going to be it, right? Because there's going to be more changes in how we understand these things. So it's a moving target. Okay. Here is, for example, the diagnosis for what's called a major depressive episode, which is part of major depressive disorder, in the DSM-4. And you don't have to write this down. You don't have to memorize it. What I want you to do is get a sense of how specific the DSM is in terms of understanding disordered behavior. So for a major depressive episode, you have to have 5 or more of these 9 symptoms during the same 2-week period. Hold on a second. And not only that, it has to represent a change from previous functioning, and you have to have either depressed mood or loss of interest or pleasure. So we don't make the diagnosis of depression lightly, because it's a very serious diagnosis that has very serious implications on behavior and on treatment and that kind of thing. Yeah, a question? Good point. We'll get to that in a second. Yep. So we've got these 5 or more of these symptoms: depressed mood, diminished interest or pleasure, weight loss or gain, in sleeping too little or sleeping too much, psychomotor agitation or retardation. You know, are you fidgeting a lot or are you just out of energy? You know, lackadaisical. Fatigue or loss of energy, worthlessness or guilt, thinking problems, decisiveness problems, recurrent thoughts of death, suicidal ideation, which is the idea of just thinking about suicide without a specific plan, or a suicide attempt or a specific plan for committing suicide, which is a much more dangerous condition than suicidal ideation. And then they also say that in addition to these 5 to 5 or more of these symptoms during the same 2-week period, you also have to experience distress or impairment in your social, occupational, or other important area of your life. And they can't be due to a substance use, which is quite common. Substance use can cause some of these symptoms. Or a medical condition. Or bereavement, you know, something that's going to normally cause you to be sad for 2 weeks at a time, or more than 2 weeks, right? If I, you know, if I'm going through a divorce, I might be sad, I might be happy, I might be sad for 2 weeks, right? However, we say there's a limit to what normal bereavement or normal sadness is after bereavement, and that's 2 months. If your bereavement lasts more than 2 months, then we start talking about either depression or what's known as we talked about it in class. What's that? PTSD. No, because it's not PTSD. It is chronic. Can't remember. Yeah. So there's some other diagnoses for these. Responses to things that would normally make people sad, right? Okay. So this is the way that we avoid diagnosing someone who doesn't really have a problem, right? We all get sad, right? We all go through depressed mood. We all go through loss of interest or pleasure in our everyday activities. We all go through weight loss or gain, in my case. We all go through sleeping problems. We all go through, fatigue. You know, we sometimes just don't want to get out of bed. We all go through feeling worthless or even guilty. We might even have thoughts of death. You know, I think about my death sometimes. I even have thought about, death by suicide, but it doesn't go on for, you know, day after day after day for 2 weeks. If these things happen occasionally, you're fine. If they start causing problems in impaired functioning and they're going on and on and on, now we have to start talking about it being something you might want to treat, right? What's the problem with diagnosing someone with a disorder? What kinds of problems does that have? So if there's no cure, there really aren't. If there's no cures and you diagnose someone, what's the problem with that? So for one thing, stigma gets attached to that diagnosis. You're labeled, right? So labeling is going to be a big problem. And let me show you what kind of a problem that is. This is from an article that was published by, I think it's David Rosenhan, in 1973, called On Being Sane in Insane Places. And here's what Rosenhan did. Rosenhan was a psychiatrist, I think, at Stanford University. And he was interested in the diagnostic process at psychiatric hospitals. And so what he did, he wanted to see if somebody showed up at a psychiatric hospital and they had some symptoms that really weren't symptoms of a disorder, would they be diagnosed with the disorder? So he gets eight of his buddies. Most of these people are highly educated, graduate degrees, PhDs. Some of them are psychologists, psychiatrists. So they all live in different states, and he says, I would like you to go to your nearest mental hospital, mental health hospital, mental, you know, asylum, and whether it's private or public doesn't matter, and I want you to go in there, and I want you to complain about hearing a voice saying the following three words, empty, hollow, and thud. What's important about this symptom is that it is not by itself a symptom of schizophrenia. But schizophrenia oftentimes has auditory hallucinations. But those auditory hallucinations are most typically a familiar voice that someone experiences as coming from outside them. And they're oftentimes very critical voices. You know, they're very blaming, very, very disturbing. And these are not, hearing a voice in your head saying those words is not a symptom of schizophrenia itself. Otherwise, he said, he wants them to give their own medical and social history. Don't make anything up except for this symptom. And what he wants to find out is how many of them, first of all, would be diagnosed, but secondly, would be admitted. And he actually didn't think that the numbers were going to be as high as they were. Guess how many got admitted? All of them. Every last one of them, including Rosenhan himself. Right? Now, here's the problem. Rosenhan says, I've been admitted. Now, I need to tell you that I'm part of a research program at Stanford University, and we're looking at the likelihood that people will be admitted, right? And the doctor says, yeah, sure you are. That's obviously a symptom of your disorder. So any normal behavior that they engaged in, like trying to talk themselves out of the place, taking notes, sitting outside the cafeteria waiting for lunch, these all became interpreted in the diagnostic notes as symptoms of schizophrenia. Okay. So once you get diagnosed with something, your behavior starts being seen from a different perspective, right? Not only do other people see your behavior from a different perspective, but we also see our own behaviors from a different perspective once we've had a diagnosis too. So so it creates this whole problem in thinking about the disorder. Here's the funny thing about this study. Almost invariably, guess who in the hospital knew that they weren't crazy? The other patients, the people who were actually psychotic, would oftentimes come up to them and they'd say, you're a reporter, right? You're not really psychotic. So the label of the diagnosis created in the minds of the clinicians the idea that this person has a disorder. But people who hadn't labeled them were able to see it. Okay, so this would all be fun and games if after a couple of days the doctor said, obviously you're not psychotic, so we'll see you later. But that didn't happen, did it? How long do you suspect it took for them to be released?
A couple of months.
Actually, that was one of the longest, 52 days. The average was 19 days. The shortest amount of time was a week. Now, it's important to note that once you're diagnosed with schizophrenia, you will be given medication, antipsychotics. And when you take antipsychotics and you're not psychotic, it does bad things to you. And so they weren't force medicated because they weren't out of control. And they were able to avoid taking the antipsychotics. Okay, and it wasn't over. Another problem with diagnosis and labeling is that it sticks with you. And when they were actually discharged from the facility, their patient notes, which are probably still on record somewhere, say that they had schizophrenia, which is now in remission. So you don't get away from the diagnosis. It's going to follow you. So when we label someone with a disorder like this, it's very serious business. And so one of the reasons that the DSM is so detailed and so specific is we don't want people to be diagnosed when they really don't have these disorders. So that doesn't mean that people who don't have the disorders don't get diagnosed. There are some misdiagnoses out there, but the DSM helps to avoid that in listing the specific conditions that are required. Yeah, question. I would say they are careful, yeah. And one of the things that can happen is once you have a diagnosis, if you need to get medical insurance and you're not coming out of a group plan or you're going into an individual plan, it will sometimes be a cause for either denying coverage or restricting the coverage in terms of that pre-existing condition. So it is a problem, and because of the stigma that's associated with these diagnoses, for example, schizophrenia, and people who don't understand that schizophrenia is a treatable illness, they may discriminate against you if they know you have it. And so if it's in your medical record somewhere and someone gets a hold of it, maybe they won't rent to you or they won't, give you a job. Obviously, under most conditions, you don't have access to medical records, but...
I hold a federal work study position for Washington County Community Corrections.
Okay.
Yeah. What they're doing is they're getting these cover letters from DHS and saying what they want, what they want them to say.
What DHS wants the diagnosis to be. And so are they diagnosing strictly on the letters, or are they actually meeting with the clients?
They're meeting with the clients.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
These cover letters. Now they have this kind of system going on where the attorneys are trying to secretly get their clients in to be evaluated by someone affiliated with their firm, so that when they go to court with these, and they're getting mismatched diagnosis, and they're getting, someone comes back with something one time, and then they don't the next time, and so I would just say that the credibility is not always.
Yeah, that's, it's really one of the, It's really, a diagnosis is still an art at this point. It's not so much a science. The DSM-5 hopefully will be better because it'll be more rooted in science. But at this point, diagnoses can vary dramatically from one clinician to another, depending, for example, on their theoretical perspective on the disorders.
Right. Some have more experience with domestic violence.
Sure.
Some don't. I just noticed there's a different dynamic.
Yeah. It's very important to get someone who's seen a lot of patients who have something similar to what they're going through. Yeah, Tara?
I was going to ask if that,
a major depressive episode, yeah.
Is that a part of a bigger problem?
Yes.
Okay, because I was like, is that really a problem in itself, like a TV going
It is a problem because it's going to cause a problem in your functioning, but it's generally part of either major depressive disorder or bipolar the depressed part of bipolar disorder. Yeah.
Severe.
Not by itself.
Yeah.
If it keeps going on, right, over time. Again, duration and frequency is something we always think about.
My sister is at the Air Force Academy.
Yeah. Okay.
So now she's finally gone, but she's not, and she wants to get kicked out. And if she leaves, she has to owe the money for the rest of her life. And the only way that she can leave in her third year without owing the money is to go on medical comp.
Oh, okay.
And, like, the whole time that this was going on, I'm all scared because my mom calls me and she's like, your sister's in a mental hospital. But then my sister calls me and she's fine. And she's like, what's going on? And talking to me, and I know her really well, and it's not just, they put her on, like, antidepressants and stuff, and she didn't want to take them,
mm-hmm.
but she, like, agreed to, and I feel like right now, so they did all these evaluations with her over time, and now she's on medical comp, she's gone, but it's not official that she's out of the academy yet, and now they're doing, like, all these reviews about her to see if she's fit to come back to duty and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it doesn't have anything to do with what she's doing now. It's review of how she was when she was there.
Right.
And it seems really, I think it's misinterpreted.
Yeah.
But I think she obviously influenced it.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
I'm glad. I don't want her to be there, but.
Yeah. I mean, if you know the symptoms, you may be able to fool a clinician into giving you a diagnosis that you want. And that itself is actually a disorder. Yeah. So now here's the deal. She's in a situation that she wants to get out of, and her way of figuring out how to get out of that is to try to come up with this diagnosis.
Any
competent clinician should be able to figure out what is situational and what is chronic. So yeah, like we were saying, not all clinicians are equally skilled in all disorders. So yeah. It's really. You can. Yeah, you can. You can fake out a clinician and appear to be normal. However, there are oftentimes indicators that you're not consciously monitoring.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, fidgeting behavior, the way that you look, the way that are you able to dress yourself appropriately, things like that can be more objective indicators than the subjective reports that they're going to be getting. Yeah. But what good does that do anybody ultimately? If you're disturbed and you need help. That's a huge problem. So one of the problems with people actually getting help for their disorders is the stigma that they have toward the disorder, right? So the individuals who are psychologically disturbed and need help don't get help because they're afraid. Yeah, that's a huge problem. Yeah. We'll talk more about treatment next time.